For the week of May 24th, this is Showbiz Sandbox, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. Back from Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Welcome back, Sperling. It's Karen Woodward, stuck in LA as usual.
Well, you know, we were going to, I know we had Michael Giltz on last week. We were going to try and get him on again today. He is presently traveling from Nice to the UK. So given that it's Memorial Day, nobody was free to join us. So it's just
Karen and I. I'm so bummed. I miss Michael. He was fun. Well, give it your best shot. Tell us about Cannes.
Well, yesterday, Sunday the 24th, they announced the prizes for, or the awards at the Cannes Film Festival, as they do every year on the last day of the festival. The top award is the Palme d'Or, which is means the Golden Palm in French. It was given to Austrian director Michael Haneke, whose last film, Cachet, or in English it's known as Hidden, won an award, I believe a directing award. But this was a film that played relatively late in the festival. It was shot in black and white, and it got really good word of mouth and a lot of good reviews. The name of Haneke's film, I guess we never even stated it, is The White Ribbon. It's set at the outset of World War I in a German community, and it tells the story of several different characters, a pastor, a baron, a doctor, and all of these tenant farmers that work for the baron. And the school teacher in the town, which is a very small rural town, narrates the story as he investigates all of these strange occurrences that happen. And Haneke is known for telling a story that doesn't really have an outcome or doesn't really have an ending that is very specific. So he leaves.
Wait, what kind of strange stuff was happening? Like,
well, it opens with the doctor riding on a horse, and the horse trips over this little tiny tripwire. And then when everybody goes back to investigate, the tripwire is gone.
So it's like Lost.
Right. I mean, there's all these like really bad things that the baron's child goes missing. They find him. He's hanging upside down in the barn, and he's been beaten. And who is doing all of this? They never really say. But really what a lot of people believed was that it was really not necessarily about World War I, but more about World War II, because all of the parents in the town, the baron, the pastor, the doctor, they're not the nicest people in the world. And one of them is molesting their children. The other one is,
is
psychologically torturing their children. So these are the children that grew up and voted for Hitler and you know, let Hitler take over. So I think that it was really more a comment on National Socialism than it was about World War I. But it's shot in pristine black and white, and the acting is phenomenal as usual. Now, what's interesting is that Haneke, the director, made a film in 2001 called The Piano Teacher, which Isabelle Huppert, the French actress, starred in. She happened to be the president of this year's Cannes jury, and that jury awarded Haneke.
All right, that seems a little fishy, don't you think?
Well, that film, The Piano, first of all, it was a great film. Secondly, that film, The Piano Teacher, won the grand prize at Cannes, or the Grand Prix, as it's known, in Cannes in 2001. And so that's like not necessarily the runner-up prize, but it's well, I guess the runner-up prize.
I don't care. She should have recused herself or something.
It's a little strange. But I don't know how else you're going to do it. I mean, Haneke is always invited to Cannes. Isabelle Huppert is a national treasure in France. So, you know, at some point, there was going to be a conflict there. So the Cannes jury awarded Haneke's The White Ribbon, the Palme d'Or. The jury prize, or the grand prize for this year, went to a film called A Prophet, which we spoke about last week, which is the Jacques Audiard film. It was a French film about a man in prison and how he survives and how he winds up becoming one of the prison toughs. And the special jury prize went to Alain René's Wild Grass, which is a film I saw. I can't even begin to describe what it's about. It is completely incomprehensible.
All right, then don't try. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that most people only care about Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's film starring Brad Pitt.
Which won no awards except Christoph Waltz for Best Actor. And it also focuses around a war, this one, World War II. It's, as many of Quentin Tarantino's films are, an ensemble piece. And it tells the story of a group of Jewish American soldiers put together by Aldo Raines, which is a character played by Brad Pitt. And they go to Europe ahead of the Allies and begin to kill off Nazis. It's
Sounds like a real comedy.
It's completely fictional. It has nothing to do with reality. It rewrites the ending of World War II, or tries to. And as somebody said, Tarantino is trying to reboot World War II the way J.J. Abrams rebooted the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah, good luck with that.
It's a very long movie. It was 2 hours and 40 minutes, screened on Wednesday. It received mostly favorable reviews. Many of the critics that were there, I guess they were expecting way too much out of Tarantino. I'm not a huge Tarantino fan. I'm not a huge detractor either. But they were expecting, I guess, I don't know, The Second Coming, Gone with the Wind. I'm not sure. But they were some were disappointed. However,
did anybody explain why Bastards is spelled wrong?
Actually, somebody asked Tarantino that. And I could play a clip if you want. And that it would explain that.
By all means, set it up and play it.
Here's the thing. I'm never going to explain that. You know, when you do an artistic flourish like that, to describe it, to explain it, is just take the piss out of it and invalidate the whole stroke in the first place. You know, Basquiat takes a letter L from a hotel room door and sticks it on his painting. If he describes why he did it, he might as well not have done it at all. So there you go. That's my answer.
All right. Well, I'm going to guess here that the inside joke is the fact that the entire script, from what I understand, was riddled with typos, and that just happened to be one of them.
I wouldn't doubt it. Really, it should be called Inglorious Supporting Characters, because he falls in love with his supporting characters, and I enjoyed the film. I thought it was entertaining. It's not anything heavy. It's not anything that – it's not Pulp Fiction. It's not a masterpiece, despite what Tarantino would have you believe. But it is – it was entertaining. It was engaging. 2 hours into it, I realized, wow, you know what? I'm actually engaged by this. And the more I thought about it, the more I felt it was worth seeing. It's, again, not his best film ever, but he's going to have a hard time topping Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. Pulp Fiction? Okay, Pulp Fiction. Has he done anything since then that is even worth watching? Really?
Some people really liked Kill Bill. I found Kill Bill to be overly long. He really needs somebody to come in and make him edit. The first scene in this movie.
Well, he needs somebody who can tell him no.
That is correct. And the first scene in Inglourious Basterds is over 20 minutes long. Now, it's a...
Oh, come on. That's like violating like screenwriting 101.
It's a riveting scene. And the actor who won the Best Actor Award in Cannes, Christoph Waltz, is this German actor. He speaks French, German, and English. And he is unbelievable. He really makes the film. Brad Pitt is in it. He was in Cannes with Angelina.
Was it crazy?
He actually did a good job, but he played a character. He played, you know, he's a good character actor, and this is a perfect example of how to use Brad Pitt well. And we have a clip here of how Brad Pitt explaining how he wound up in the film.
Quentin came to visit in sometime at the end of the summer with the script. And all I know, we talked about it. We talked about backstory. We talked about movies till the wee hours of the night. And I got up the next morning and I saw 5 empty bottles of wine laying on the floor, 5, and something that resembled a smoking apparatus. I don't know what that was about. And apparently, I agreed to do the movie because 6 weeks later, I was in uniform and I was Lieutenant Aldo Raines. So. Go figure. Listen, he took, you know, he's been working on this script 8 years, and he said that night, we're going to make Cannes, and this was August or something ridiculous, and it was, I knew it instantly upon reading it. These ones don't come along very often, and I felt very privileged and that I'd earned this moment. So I was really happy to finally arrived. Can I say that? And literally, 6 weeks later, we were shooting. As I say, we wrapped 3 months ago, and here we are. And I wish all films could be made this way.
I found that clip interesting because the Inglourious Basterds people, the cast, the crew, they didn't really do much press. So the one thing they did do was a press conference for the international journalists that had gathered. And it was like they were drinking champagne up on the podium and they were having a good old time. And I found it very interesting that Brad Pitt felt loose enough to explain that he and Quentin Tarantino were out smoking doobies talking about talking about their...
Well, you can talk about that in France.
I guess that's true. More so in Amsterdam, but or in Holland. But.
I'm surprised he did it with Angelina there, because I hear she's completely against all that kind of stuff.
Well, Angelina wasn't at the press conference, although I'm sure she... Well,
she might have been. Just because you didn't see it, I mean, she wasn't there.
Oh, I would. Everybody would have seen it. She never would have... I mean, there's no way she could have set foot in that room without half of Cannes knowing. So she...
There's no, like, backstage or something?
No, there is no backstage. That's part of the problem. Now, what's interesting about Inglourious Basterds is most of it is in German and French, so you're reading a lot of subtitles.
And boring.
And it is chock full of dialogue. I mean, wall-to-wall dialogue. There are scenes that go on and on and on and on. They're interesting. They're engaging. He's a very good writer, but they really do need to be edited.
So are we talking, like, Academy Award winner here, or?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
Nominee?
Well, except for Christoph Waltz, who was very good in the film. That I could see.
Oh, he'll probably get overlooked for that, and Brad Pitt will get all the accolades.
I don't know. Well, another film I hope that doesn't get overlooked is the Camera D'Or winner, Samson and Delilah. This was the film we talked about last week about the Australian Aborigines, directed and produced and edited and shot by Warwick Thornton. I mean, I think he did everything on the film. So the Camera D'Or is for the first given to a first-time filmmaker. It was given to that film, Samson and Delilah. Charlotte Gainsbourg won the Best Actress Award for Antichrist, which is Lars von Trier.
The movie you hated so much last week, right?
You know, the more I thought about it, the more I felt like, well, you know, it's not anything I would want to see again, but it wasn't a horrible movie. It just was very difficult. It seemed somewhat pointless, but 2 days later, people were still talking about it. And it was picked up for distribution by IFC Films, so it will be released in the United States in North America. Now, it will probably be released without a rating, since Charlotte Gainsbourg is seen masturbating quite voraciously in the middle of the woods. Yeah, so I can't imagine that they will actually be able to rate that. A little shocking was Brillante Mendoza, the Philippine director, won the Best Director Award for Kinete, a film that not a lot of people liked, and they liked his previous Cannes entry, Cerbis, which I believe was in last year's festival. They liked that even less. And so I avoided that film this year, Kinete, because I had no desire to see his work. In the end, he wound up getting the Best Director Award. Now, the jury prize was split this year. It went to Fish Tank from Andrea Arnold out of the UK, which was the film that was kind of like the British version of 13. And it went to Thirst, which was the vampire movie that we talked about last week.
Right.
The Korean vampire movie by Park Chan-wook.
Is that it for Cannes?
That's it for Cannes. The only other film I saw was I Love You, Jim Carrey. No, what the heck was the name of that film? I Love You. I can't remember the name. I mean, Jim Carrey was there because he was... Robert Zemeckis brought Christmas Carol, and they screened...
Was he there with Jenny McCarthy?
He was there with Jenny McCarthy, walking around outside the Carlton Hotel, out by the beach, and they put all this snow outside the Carlton Hotel. They made it snow in the middle of May, and he was there with Colin Firth and Robert Zemeckis and Jack Rapke and Steve Starkey, and they just talked to the press about this 3D animated film that, of course, was done with motion capture, and they brought it to Cannes to show to the international press, and it's being released in November, 3 weeks before Jim Cameron's Avatar.
Aha! And in November, so someone's going for an Academy Award, right?
Yes. Well, also, I guess...
It's not a comedy,
it's
is
It's a
it?
Christmas Carol, so...
Ah.
It's Dickens' Christmas Carol, so...
Oh, God, how many times does that need to be done?
One journalist said to me, isn't it interesting that this guy thinks he's big enough to make not one, but two Christmas movies? Because Zemeckis made a Polar Express.
Right.
So, but Jim Carrey was also there because his film, I Love You, Philip Morris was the name of it. And that screened down at the director's Fortnite. And it was an interesting movie and very entertaining and a crowd pleaser. But in the end, I think it's about a gay couple played by Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor, and how they meet in prison and their relationship and how it unfolds. Quite frankly, Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor had no chemistry whatsoever.
Chemistry?
Yeah.
Yikes. Well, you missed some good stuff in the States.
I heard Terminator Salvation was okay, but not great.
You know, I don't know anybody who's seen it, but all the critics are like, yeah, it's okay. You know, Christian Bale is better than it needs to be. And basically, people have not gotten excited about it. So much so that Night at the Museum won the box office. $70 million. Terminator only got 53. Ouch.
Well, in 500 fewer screens. Although...
Well, but still, I mean, Terminator, first of all, I'm sort of surprised that it wasn't on more screens. And second of all, I mean, I think people really expected that movie to do exceptionally well. I mean, certainly to win the weekend.
What I found interesting about the box office this weekend is that Angels and Demons dropped to fourth place and dropped 40% to and made $27.7 million. And Star Trek jumped up to third place, or I guess stayed in third place or second place. I mean, I guess it fell to third place, but it beat Angels and Demons. That's really what I'm trying to get.
Well, I think it's because I finally saw it. My ticket really made the difference.
So your ticket was, you paid $29.4 million?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
Well,
no, just the difference between Star Trek and Angels and Demons. My ticket was like a couple million.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. $2 million almost. Yeah,
Have you seen this movie? I think we've talked about this before, but I can't remember.
Angels and Demons?
No, Star Trek.
Oh, yes, I have.
I thought it was so good.
It was really good. I mean, J.J. Abrams, the director, really rebooted that franchise, in my opinion.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, he really did a great job.
And Chris Pine is a star. I know some people think that he is lacking in gravitas to be Captain Kirk, but I totally disagree. I thought he was perfect. Really funny, really sexy, a leading man.
Yeah, he was good. And the what's his name? Who plays Spock? Whose name?
Zachary Quinto.
He did a great
He's
job.
So good in this.
I really liked it.
Yeah.
Well, it only dropped 31%. It was playing on 4,053 screens, which is actually up 200 screens, and to date has made $191 million.
By the way, I didn't know that Spock was supposed to be half human. Did not know that.
I knew very little about Star Trek, so I know very little about the mythology and about the character, so I really enjoyed it.
Well, I saw it with a boy, and so he had to explain to me later what I was watching, because I was like, yeah, I didn't understand that whole like time travel thing. And he was like, Karen, that was the whole movie. Like, I don't know, I just like watching the characters.
Well, one thing that I thought about this week as I was in Cannes seeing art films, foreign art films.
Were you thinking about American Idol?
I was thinking more about how you and Michael last week argued over whether Adam Lambert or Chris Allen would win, and that Chris Allen actually won. Because I think you were for Adam Lambert.
I was for Adam Lambert. Chris Allen winning is just a complete travesty of justice.
I could care less about this subject, but I know you and hundreds of millions of people actually care.
Okay, I don't watch American Idol. Never. I mean, I saw like the last one of the first season just because I wanted to see what the big deal was about. My sister got me turned into this. I mean, I started voting, okay? And it was because when I first started watching it this season, I didn't tune in until like halfway through. And I saw Adam Lambert's performance of Mad World. And to me, that's kind of when the whole thing clicked in. I was like, this is a real talent. And he's on the cover of magazines. All the judges wanted you to vote for him. I mean, he is no question. He is an incredible talent. Chris Allen, on the other hand, was a complete no talent. And what kills me is that America voted for him because they're like scared of a flamboyant talent who's probably gay, and they don't like what they don't understand, so they just don't vote for him. It's just a good travesty of American Idol justice. Our American Idol should have been Adam Lambert.
Chris Allen then is American Idol's crash to Adam Lambert's Brokeback Mountain.
Yes, that is exactly it. That's exactly it. And it's just so disappointing. Like, I'm not disappointed for Adam. He's going to have a career. He seems fine. And Chris Allen seems like a really nice guy. But what kills me is that, like, America just really screwed up here.
According to Billboard.com, Queen is considering Lambert as their frontman because, of course, Freddie Mercury passed away.
Well, I hope he says no. He's actually, they were, he and Adam and Chris were doing a duet together, and they they were singing We Are the Champions, and then Queen came out, and it was a moment. And there was some blogger somewhere who said that like when the guys first started singing, that it sounded like Chris was laying down like the referral track, and then Adam came out to sing the real song. That's exactly what it was. But he was really good, but I don't think he needs to be the lead singer for Queen. He could do anything he wants.
According to a couple things I read, the voting was nowhere close, and that Chris Allen actually won by
quite a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, and 100 million votes were cast.
Yeah, it's to me, it's very upsetting that America would choose safe over talent. That's to me is the most upsetting thing. We are still homophobes.
Well, it wasn't the worst American Idol ratings-wise ever.
It wasn't? I thought it was pretty low.
The show tied for its least watched finale of the modern Idol era.
You know, I think that has less to do with Adam Lambert and Chris Allen and more to do with the fact that the show's been on for such a long time. I'm not sure people really care quite as much.
Well, 28.84 million people watched it.
I was one of them. I voted, okay, over and over and over again. I accidentally gave my sister the wrong number, and she voted for Chris Allen like 30 times. And then when she found out that I had screwed up, she was so mad at me, and she made me sit down. We voted for Adam Lambert like 30 times each.
Don't you have to pay for that? Don't you?
No. Free.
Oh, okay. I thought you had to pay for...
No, absolutely free. You can vote as many times as you want.
Well, nearly 29 million people is down from 2003's Idol... when Ruben, the American Idol in 2003, 38 million people watched Ruben Studdard win. I think that was also the year that Clay Aiken was.
Yeah, it was second. Another travesty of American Idol justice. Not that I think Clay Aiken's all that talented, but he clearly should have been the American Idol. I mean, it seems so obvious to me.
Well, it's definitely, that show is definitely waning, because in 2006, Taylor Hicks had 36.4 million people watching that finale. And David Cook last year, who won, had 31.7 million people watching.
He
and
is
in
so
2007,
cute, oh.
Now Sorry. Carrie Underwood was an American Idol.
Yeah,
I had no idea. She had 30.3 million for her finale, and I guess Kelly Clarkson had the least
watched. Well, that was because that was the first season, and people really didn't know. You know, it hadn't really caught on quite yet. I totally remember that season. I was working at Fox that season, right next to the publicity department.
I would have thought that stuff. I would have thought that she would have gotten more than 22.8 million people.
Well, but that was the first season. I mean, it was a hit, but it wasn't a phenomenon yet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was that season that made that show.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that she went on, I think, to such fame is what actually helps make this show so popular, because more and more people, you know, watch it and audition for it, and because she's the poster child, she and Carrie Underwood are the poster child for what you want to be. But clearly, if you're a guy, it doesn't really matter if you win American Idol.
Well, I can tell you, if you're a guy like me, I could care less about American Idol.
Yeah, but like the biggest guy, the guy who has won the most amount of fame off American Idol is Chris Daughtry, who's in the band Daughtry. And he came in like fourth place, and it was another travesty of American Idol justice when he was voted off. I watched a little bit that season, but he was clearly incredibly talented. And look, you know? You don't have to win. I mean, where are Soul Patrol and Ruben Studdard doing right now? Nothing. They're getting kicked off their labels.
In the UK, a lot was made over the fact that Katie Holmes and Suri Cruz were in the audience with
Why
all
was
the
that
A-list
such a
stars.
Big deal? There are a lot of famous people there. There always have been. What's the big deal there?
I have no idea. It was like all the gossip in the Daily Mail and other UK tabloids.
Well, what I think is interesting is that Suri was not wearing those little headphone, you know, the head thingies that kids wear to protect their ears. And in the picture,
oh, kid muffs. They're called kid muffs.
Yeah, and in the picture that I saw, Katie Holmes is like holding her hands over Suri's ears, but like, hey, mom, let's see if we can do something to protect your kid's ears, because she's probably sitting in the front row.
Yeah, like not show up.
Yeah.
What? Or not bring your
kid. Who cares?
Kid.
I don't even care if these people show up. I don't care. Cameron Manheim was there too. I don't have a beef with either Katie Holmes or Cameron Manheim showing up. What bothers me is that real, like, fans, normal people fans can't get in because Suri Cruz, little three-year-old, has got to see this. That does bother me, I suppose.
Well, she can have my ticket.
I want to go.
It's right here in Hollywood. You probably could go.
It was at the Nokia Theater. Where the hell is the Nokia Theater?
Oh, that's downtown right next to the Staples Center. It's in downtown Los Angeles. Oh. It's brand new. They just built it a year or two ago.
you know, another person who's talked about this finale was Pink.
Yeah, what's the deal with her? I guess she didn't like something that occurred on the show.
First of all, I just want to say I'm a huge fan of Pink. I don't know why. No, they sang her song, So What? So What? I'm Still a Rock Star, which is actually sort of an interesting choice, being that it's about her divorce from her husband, which they are not back together. But the song is about divorce.
Is she going to write a song about that, too?
About divorce?
I was divorced, but now I'm back with my husband.
Yeah, probably. But the song has got a line in it, So What, I'm Still a Rock Star, which of course is, you know, why the American Idol producers chose for the people to sing it. And it was one of those big finale numbers where everybody's come back and they're, you know, doing their stage routine and they're all kind of pushing the blind guy around, which I thought was hysterical. And she said something, I thought it was weird because she was like, she said over Twitter, I heard that my song got really butchered last night, but... Didn't she know that they were going to sing her song? Doesn't she have to give them permission?
Not really. No, they can just pay. But they can just pay the fees. I mean, it's a cover song, so you're allowed to cover other people's work. You just have to pay them.
Oh. Oh, okay. I thought you had to like go through like all the like proper permissions.
Well, I could be wrong about that, but I don't believe so. I think you just have to pay the ASCAP fees.
Oh, what was okay? Well, that was That's the Pink story. Frankly, she should be lucky. I mean, it's making her relevant again.
Speaking of Twitter, just this weekend, I read something about, I think it was in, well, it was in Variety and on CNET, that let me pull it up here. San Francisco-based Web Phenom has partnered with Reveille and Brillstein Entertainment to develop an unscripted TV scheme described as, quote, putting ordinary people on the trail of celebrities in a revolutionary competitive format.
I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
I have no idea. But if they turn regular people into celebrity stalkers or paparazzi, I think Twitter may have jumped the shark.
Yeah. I mean, as it is, the fact that people, you know, over a million people follow like Ashton Kutcher and any of these other celebrities, I find that a little alarming enough. But the fact that they're, I don't know, that's like a pop culture jumping the shark moment. Something so inherently wrong about that.
I don't see how Twitter could be turned into a TV show, but I have been wrong before. In fact, I was wrong about Twitter in 2006 when I was first shown this web application.
No, you weren't. You tuned me onto Twitter.
Right. Well, that was 2007. Speaking of which, you can follow me on Twitter at Sperling.
And I am at KWoody3939.
I can't believe Twitter is going to be turned into a reality television show, but I do like what Variety and or CNET said about it, that they called it Realitweet TV.
Yeah. Well, this is stalking. This should be illegal. I don't get it. I could understand using Twitter to have like a scavenger hunt. That's kind of what Ellen does for her show, Ellen DeGeneres. But to put people on the trail of celebrities, I mean, unless it's like sort of the celebrities have given permission and it's like, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, or a celebrity apprentice, I'm not sure that that could be legal.
Well, wait a second. Speaking of Ellen.
Yeah.
Did you not go to
the Ellen
show?
I took that off our list. I did. I went to the Backyard Bash with No Doubt. It was really fun.
That's where I read. I was reading about that, and I realized now I was reading it in our show notes.
Yeah, no, I took it off because I didn't think that we would get around to talking about it. And it was really just me gloating about the fact that I went to the Ellen Show Backyard Bash.
Was it fun?
It was so good.
Did you have a good time?
I did. It was fun. It was, you know, they were wholly unprepared for the amount of people who came, which seems really rather irresponsible to me. They turned away like 2,000 people, which, again, seems wholly irresponsible to me.
Now, what is this Backyard Bash?
Really what it is that No Doubt is going on tour just for the summer, and they don't have a new album. They're just playing their old stuff. And in kicking off their tour, they were going to go on The Ellen Show, and I'm sure that just gave The Ellen Show producers, they just said, let's make a whole, you know, concert out of it. So it was in the backyard, that was in the back lot of Warner Brothers on May 18th. And it was so hot. Oh, my God, it was hot. And there were so many people there. And my friend and I, we had guaranteed seats. But, of course, that doesn't mean anything. And they just didn't know what to do with us. It was ridiculous. It was sponsored by Breyers Ice Cream. So we got some free ice cream out of it. That was fun. They were really good about quenching our thirst. There was water everywhere. But they didn't know what to do with us. So, basically, they just kind of like looked the other way as we pushed more and more forward. So I got a pretty decent spot.
And they, really how many fun. Songs did they sing? Was it a full concert? Or
they
was
sang
it
three. They sang three. They sang "Hella Girl." "Hella Good," "Just a Girl," and "Hey Baby." And "Hey Baby" okay. was the one that was not aired. The other two were.
Well, so now speaking of musicians, I keep using that "speaking of." I don't know why. I have to.
Yeah, get or one it. Person. One person who was not at the Backyard Bash was Chase Crawford.
Hey, speaking of which, Chase Crawford, not to skip ahead here, but I heard he is standing in for Zac Efron.
Yeah, standing in. He's taking the place of. He's not the understudy. Although I guess he sort of is. Yeah, no, Zac Efron was going to do the remake of Footloose and probably made a very good career decision in not doing it. And then Chase Crawford from Gossip Girl stepping in, which I'm sure is a huge mistake because the guy can't act. Who knows whether he can dance and sing, but he's certainly no Kevin Bacon. And, you know, although Zac Efron gets a lot of abuse, he's actually, I think, a pretty talented guy.
So here's my question. Mm-hmm. Why are they remaking Footloose?
Because that's what Paramount does. I'm not even sure this is a Paramount movie, but I can almost guarantee you that it is. Paramount, is it? Look at that. It is. Paramount likes to play it safe and they remake stuff. That's really the only reason I can think of. But I feel incredibly old. I mean, I remember when this movie came out. I saw it in the theaters like three times.
I saw it in the theater too, so that's dating myself.
I was going to marry Ren McCormick. I didn't care about Kevin Bacon. I was going to marry Ren McCormick. I was going to be
Footloose,
Ren McCormick.
Footloose is the film starring Kevin Bacon. It helped launch Kevin Bacon's career in the early 80s, and it was about – and John Lithgow.
No, and again, if you don't know Footloose, you shouldn't be listening to this podcast. Really, Google Footloose. Put it on your Netflix queue. It's such a good movie. It's a classic.
It's a classic.
I'm sorry, but Chase Crawford is no Kevin Bacon. Having said all that, though, and having made fun of Chase Crawford, I would totally see this movie. But only because I love the original so much. It's got good music and stuff. And I'm curious to know who they've cast for the girl, who I believe they actually already have, and I just don't know who it is. But Laurie Singer, who was in the original, was so awful. I don't know how you could find anybody worse, so I'm really kind of curious.
Isn't Zac Efron still on High School Musical, or is he completely done with that?
Well, yeah, skipping ahead just a little bit. There was an article in Entertainment Weekly about Disney stars growing up.
That's a fascinating article. I mean,
it's a fascinating article.
We'll put it in the show notes because it is really interesting.
Yeah, and it's about Zac Efron. He became famous from High School Musical 1, 2, and 3. He's not going to do the fourth one. In fact, I don't think any of the original cast is going to do the fourth one. But that article is all about what happened to Disney kids as they grow up. And
including Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, Miley Cyrus, and who plays Hannah Montana, and
Lindsay Lohan.
Selena Gomez, who is in Wizards of Waverly Place. It's sort of scary how well I know the Disney kids. David Henry, who's in Wizard of Waverly Place, although I don't think he's mentioned in this article. But I mean, Disney's really smart. I mean, they've made a huge conglomerate out of what they've basically recreated the studio system.
I was told by a TV packaging agent once that they always cut deals with their talent that are 3 years. And if the show is popular, they won't renew it because they don't want to have to pay these stars lots of money. And so they cut these 3-year deals with people like Zac Efron and Miley Cyrus, and that way they also never have to pay for the reruns, the residuals on syndication, and they can syndicate it as much as they want because paying themselves. Yeah. Now I don't know how true that is.
No, I believe that because not only is Disney well known for being really miserly, but they're well known for being really miserly to the Disney Channel kids.
Well, this is a fascinating article.
It is, but you know, one thing I thought was really interesting is that it talks about. Vanessa Hudgens, who's also in a High School Musical, and she had naked pictures of her all over the internet, and it addresses that. But that Disney basically said, you know, teenagers act dumb sometimes, and you know that's that. But I thought that whole incident was really interesting because they could have just kind of, you know, shunned her and been like, you know, not supported her at all. But instead, they really did, and I think that's really interesting. They kind of mother these children in like a bad way, you know, in like a Brooke Shields mom kind of way. They kind of like own them, which is really rather frightening, and they don't pay them very much. But they do support them when times are tough, and they start these kids' careers. And if you're smart, like Zac Efron, you just, you know, move up and move on. And you can kind of look at the stars right now that you can tell are going to move up and move on. And you can see the ones that are just never going to break out of the Disney mold. I'm looking at you, Sprouse Brothers.
Well, I don't know how we got started on the Zac Efron of it all.
Because of Footloose.
Footloose, and then I guess American Idol and yeah. Twitter.
Yeah.
But one story I had highlighted was the British version of American Idol, which is where it all started. Britain's Got Talent, which Simon Cowell is also on.
Yep.
Earlier this year in April.
By the way, that's not the British version of American Idol.
I was hoping you wouldn't correct me on that. I realized it after I said it. Yeah, I know.
Go on.
But earlier this year, this woman named Susan Boyle comes out on stage. She looks like...
Everybody knows the Susan Boyle, don't they?
Well, about 70 million people do.
You don't have to explain the Susan Boyle story. Everyone's seen it.
Anyway, she's the frumpy housewife who came out. Nobody thought she could sing.
Not a housewife. She's like never been kissed.
She's never been kissed. Everybody was ready to write her off. She comes out. She sings this amazing song from Les Mis, the Broadway show, and she wows everybody. The expression on Simon Cowell's face was priceless. They put this thing up on YouTube. It gets 75 million views on one stream alone. But what the New York Times is saying is that there's really no money in it for the producers of Britain's Got Talent. They write here, in the days after Miss Boyle's debut, the Times of London published what it called a quote-unquote crude estimate, suggesting that the parties involved had left $1.87 million on the table. That is based on 75 million streams of the various clips of Miss Boyle, which the newspaper estimated could get $20 to $35 for every 1,000 views in the United States, and more than that in Britain. Well, they probably didn't leave that much money on the table, but obviously the producers of Britain's Got Talent should have cut a deal with YouTube to get in on the advertising revenue. They didn't, and after 75 million views of this clip of Susan Boyle...
Too late.
Yep, they have nothing to show for it.
Although,
a lot of people are watching this show now, and apparently over this past weekend, Susan Boyle made it to the finals by singing Memory from Cats.
Oh, God, like we've never heard that one before. Yeah, no, I read in Entertainment Weekly this week that... that it's actually not that we in America assume it's like a given that she's going to win, but apparently there are other people who are equally talented, and she's really going to have to, you know, fight to win this.
The other big news in television this week was the upfronts were this week in New York. That was the big news in television this
week. We've talked about that the past couple weeks.
Right. And so rather than go over it all and tell you beat by beat what each network picked up and didn't pick up, obviously,
on the highlights.
Yeah, Fox, they're the big network on campus these days, or the big network on television, mainly because they have American Idol, and it has 69% more viewers than the next nearest hit TV show, which is Desperate Housewives. I find that fascinating. And we talked earlier about how much they...
Yeah, I mean, even though it's gone down, this is going to be on TV for another 10 years, at least.
But the interesting news coming out of Fox was that they tried to do this surprise attack with this show Glee, which is supposed to be a high school musical, but on Fox. They aired it after American Idol, and they dropped most of the viewers that were watching American Idol, so it didn't carry through to this new show.
I don't find that surprising at all, because I didn't see Glee, but from everything that I read, it was sort of a darkly comic, ironic show. And American Idol is definitely not that, as has been, you know, take a look at the Chris Allen results. America doesn't want irony. America doesn't want to have to think.
Well, I don't even think that show airs until sometime next year.
No, it doesn't. This was just supposed to be like a teaser, but...
Well, a show they did pick up was Bones after a lot of infighting between Fox, the production company, and Fox, the network. Fox, the production company, wanted Fox, the network, to actually pay more per episode for the show. So a lot of infighting. Who knows how it wound up, but I know the one thing we do know is that Bones was picked up for another season. Sarah Connor Chronicles, or Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles, was not picked up for another season.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Joss Whedon's... That does surprise me, because
Me. That show is so bad.
What, the Sarah Connor Chronicles or Dollhouse?
Well, both, but I was talking about Dollhouse.
Well, Dollhouse was picked up. Sarah Chronicles were not. I know a lot of people watch both, so.
And you probably watch neither.
I watch, between the two of them, none. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're so the movie guy between the two of us. Yeah, I watch everything.
I don't even watch Medium, although I do know that CBS, not NBC, picked it up. And this was a big brouhaha in the middle of the week. NBC only wanted to pick it up for 13 episodes. They had a 22-episode commitment. This is the television show that stars Patricia Arquette.
Yeah, and I think this is really smart. You know, Medium's audience is clearly for the CBS crowd, which is like, you know, 50 and above. They compare it with Ghost Whisperer, which is an equally ridiculous show. And, you know, people can be bored for 2 hours on Friday nights.
That's right. Ghost Whisperer will air at 8 o'clock. Medium will air at 9, and they've got a 22-episode pickup.
Perfect.
And
everyone's happy.
It's the same thing that happened to Scrubs. NBC didn't want to pick it up for a full season, so ABC picked it up for a full season last year. And you know,
now me, I will be over on NBC watching Friday Night Lights on Friday nights.
That's right. That's that got picked up. Although it's been pushed until the summer of 2010. That
I don't care. It got pushed up. It got picked up. That's the important thing.
Well, the big news from NBC. This is a network that just can't seem to do anything right.
Yeah.
But this time they may have. They picked up Chuck, and this was after, speaking of Twitter, a lot of outcry on Twitter and social networking sites for NBC to pick up the show, so much so that a network executive said, because of the demand for Chuck that came out of the online community, the critical community, and the advertising base, made us have to pick up that show. The other shows had none of that.
That doesn't make it a good show.
What's interesting is NBC, of course, at 10 o'clock each night, starting in the fall, Jay Leno will be doing his one-hour talk show, which is a brand-new thing, a variety talk show in prime time starting at 10 p.m., and to help bolster that, or to help promote that, they brought Jay Leno out to do a half-hour stand-up routine.
And people walked out?
People walked out, yes. The reports were that advertisers were so bored by his routine shtick about, you know, take my wife, please, and his cat, which I'm making that part up. I don't know what he said, but it wasn't apparently not very funny because they all left.
Oh, that is going to die. What are they going to do with him?
The thing is, they wanted something cheap. They got something cheap. It does not cost $2 million per episode to produce the Jay Leno show. So they have five nights of not $2 million per episode.
Yeah, they'll just force people to get used to it, I suppose. And you know what? That will probably work.
10 o'clock, if you think about it, is the catch-up hour. People get home, they have dinner, the DVR starts, they sit down around 8:30, 9 o'clock, they press play, they start watching what was on at 8. And by the time 10:30 rolls around, they're only up to 9:30. So they never really see what was on at 10 o'clock.
So your point is that the Jay Leno thing will work or will not work?
Well, NBC didn't want to spend a lot of money
on a 10 o'clock show.
Right, where they don't necessarily know that people are going to be watching, whereas the Jay Leno show is somewhat timely. You have to see it that night, or you have to see it relatively soon thereafter, because it has an immediacy that Law and Order does not. I mean, you could DVR Law and Order and watch it 4 weeks from now, and it won't matter. But if you watch the Jay Leno show 4 weeks from now, you'll see some actor or filmmaker or musician on there talking about some project that's been released 4 weeks ago.
You know what, I'm not a late night person, but I will in the morning check and see who is going to be on that for that day. I never listen to Jay Leno's or anybody else's, you know, opening monologues ever. I don't think any of them are that funny. I am funnier than some of these people.
You know, you may not watch Jay Leno. I happen to watch the Jon Stewart show.
Yeah, I watch Jon Stewart, yeah.
I mean, he's off the air by the time Jimmy Kimmel comes on. And Jimmy Kimmel's over on ABC. There was some talk that Jay Leno might be moving to ABC and going up against Conan. That never didn't happen. But Jimmy Kimmel at the upfronts, and of course the upfronts, for those who don't know, are meetings in New York where the networks reveal what their fall lineup is going to be in the new television season to advertisers, trying to get them to purchase advertising for the new television season. The fear this year was that there would be a 10% drop in the amount of advertising that advertisers purchased. And usually they purchase around $9 billion worth of advertising during this week and the weeks following. So it's a pretty big deal. And they, as we've talked about before, trot out all their talent and their executives, and they announce which shows have been picked up and which new shows will be airing.
Right.
And ABC decided to have Jimmy Kimmel come out, and the guy was brutally honest.
Did they not know what he was going to say?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. The New York Times said he did a stand-up shtick, and the New York Times called it a withering, blistering monologue that took direct aim at ABC and its potential advertisers.
I mean, according come on, really?
Well, according, this is actually, I find what he said pretty funny. And some of the one-liners were, "Everything you're going to hear this week is nonsense," he said. "Let's get real here. Let's get Dr. Phil real. The new fall shows, we're going to cancel about 90% of them, maybe more. This show, Shark Tank, has the word tank right in the title."
Yeah, but also think about what good publicity he just gave to Shark Tank.
Oh my God. It was covered by the New York Times, for Pete's sake. Yeah. What he said, as starkly true as it might be and as harsh as it might sound, and he was joking around. He wasn't being serious. But he did, you know, one of the things he said that may have raised a few eyebrows is, he said, "Every year we lie to you, and every year you come back for more. You don't need an upfront. You need therapy. We completely lie to you, and then you pass those lies on to your clients." And
he's talking to the advertisers. That might have been...
He then goes on to say, "The important thing to remember is, who cares? It's not your money."
Yeah, so, that might have been crossing the line a little bit.
I think he may have crossed the line.
A little bit.
Well, somebody else who may have crossed the line is John Peters.
Oh, that is a good story.
Did you hear about this?
Uh-huh.
This book proposal?
Actually, I didn't know about it until you told me about it.
Well, I didn't know about it until Nikki Fink over at Deadline Hollywood told everybody about it. And then, of course,
I love Nikki Fink.
All the tabloids, all the gossip rags started picking it up.
All right, well, set this up for us, because I actually think that a lot of people actually don't know who John Peters is.
John Peters is a producer who got his start in the 70s by dating. He was a hairdresser and a high school dropout, a middle school dropout. And he got his start as a hairdresser, started dating Barbara Streisand, and started producing movies. And he's produced some pretty big movies over the years, including the Batman franchise and the Superman franchise.
Yeah, but point out that he partnered with Peter Guber.
Okay, yes, he did.
And together they had a production company, and then they also ran Sony for a while. There is a book by Kim Masters called Hit and Run, talking about how the two of them basically ran the studio into the ground.
Well, Hit and Run, was it Hit and Run?
Hit and Run.
Yes, Hit and Run. And there's also another book called The Devil's Candy, which was about the making of The Bonfire of the Vanities. And what a fiasco that was, because Peter Guber and John Peters, John Peters was the good-looking, suave ladies' man who could turn heads, and he had a way with people. Peter Guber was the brains and the talent behind picking the right stories. So they went on to produce things like The Color Purple and Who's That Girl with the Madonna film and Batman, you know, the whole Batman series. And it all led up to, in 1989 or 1990, they were hired to run Sony. Well, actually, they were hired to run Columbia when Sony purchased Columbia Pictures. And they basically, as you mentioned, ran it into the ground. And The Bonfire of the Vanities was in the middle of production, and they just left that to whoever. I think it was, who the heck was, Brian De Palma was directing that.
Okay, so tell what John Peters is doing.
Oh, okay, so yeah, the whole point of the story is that John Peters, who really hasn't done much of late, I mean, he did the Superman Returns that Bryan Singer made. He produced the Superman, but I think that was only because he had
owned the Superman franchise, or
right,
not,
exactly.
Not owned it, but owned the rights to produce those movies. But otherwise, he hasn't really done anything since.
Well, he produced Ali in 2001. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, you know, a long time ago. That's how
he wrote. Yeah, Wild Wild West in 1999.
Yeah, that wasn't a big hit, was it?
Not really. No.
Yeah. No.
So he decided, I guess, who knows why, he's going to go out and write a book called Studio Head.
Who knows why? Because people will read it.
And he is not only going to, he was going to write it with William Stadium. I don't know if that's
how I don't even know who that is.
And agent David Vigliano sold the memoir earlier in the week to HarperCollins for $700,000 based on an outline. This outline Nikki Fink got a hold of and published some of these pieces. Now, John Peters was known as a ladies' man. He dated Barbara Streisand, which is one of the, as some say, he got his start by dating Barbara Streisand. But he goes into detail about having dated Pamela Anderson and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
And Leslie Ann Warren, who he was married to. Well, from what I understand, he basically said that he screwed around with everybody, so.
Except for Elle McPherson, who wouldn't give him the time of day.
Good.
Well, what I find interesting is Nikki Fink spoke with Peter Guber, and Guber said, quote, "After 4 decades in this industry, I will stand by my reputation, and John Peters should stand by his. I find it surprising that any publisher would be interested in his work of fiction."
The thing that about this that I find interesting is that how relevant is he? Like, if he was going to write a book, he probably should have written it, you know, 8 years ago.
Well, he's not very relevant, but...
Well, just the fact that we have to explain who he is reason enough for him maybe not writing a book. I mean, if he had written a book just about what Hollywood was like in those days, well, that I would be kind of interested in reading because, you know, he was front and center. But I don't really care about it. John Peters' tawdry life. What do I care?
Well, a lot of people care about Catherine Zeta-Jones and Pamela Anderson, so throwing those names around and throwing Barbara Streisand's name around.
But it's also dated at this point.
Yeah, but so is The Kid Stays in the Picture, which was the book written by, why am I blanking on his name now? Robert Evans.
Yeah.
The producer Robert Evans, who used to run Paramount during the days when Coppola was making The Godfather. And he's a big friend of Jack Nicholson's. But The Kid Stays in the Picture, because he knows all of those people, was fascinating. And it was turned into an award-winning documentary.
Yeah, but Catherine Zeta-Jones is not Jack Nicholson.
Thank goodness for that.
Yes, thank goodness for that. But I don't know. Your point's a good one. I don't know. I'm not surprised that John Peters decided to propose a book. What I am surprised is that it took him so long. I mean, what has he been doing for the past 6 years, seven?
And there's an old saying, don't kiss and tell. And he should probably heed that advice.
Yeah, but he was never the brains in his operation anyway. So did he really expect to have a Hollywood career? I mean, his career as a producer is effectively over. Not that he couldn't come back and produce more movies, but he wasn't the brains. He doesn't know how to make a movie. He just has a hell of a lot of chutzpah, and this book proposal just kind of proves that.
It was sold for $700,000 to HarperCollins.
And then canceled, right?
And then canceled because of threats of lawsuits, because all of these people that got wind of this.
And people really hate him. People really hate him. If he had been kind of a good guy, people would have been like, okay, well, whatever. But, I mean, people hate this guy. I mean, you read Hit and Run, and it's just it's unreal what he and Guber got away with. Just unreal. Just an incredibly unlikable guy. And not to the point where it would make me want to read his book. It's to the point where I would just be so disgusted. I have no desire to read his book.
Well, it certainly would have been the talk of the town when it was released.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody cares about John Peters anymore.
I don't think it's John Peters they're interested in. I think it's everybody he's mentioning.
Yeah, I suppose it could be. But again, I think a lot of people he mentions are sort of dated. I don't even care about Pamela Anderson anymore. He's trying to make himself relevant, and I understand that instinct, but unfortunately, we live in an American Idol and Disney Channel era now, and people don't care that much about Pamela Anderson and Catherine Zeta-Jones. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know, but you know, we could probably ask Roger Friedman.
Yes, yes.
You may know as the reporter who used to work for Fox, who was let go after he downloaded Wolverine off of the internet before it was released. And not only wrote about it, but then reviewed the film or proceeded to talk about the film that he had just seen after downloading it off the internet. Well, Fox News, which is who he worked for, is owned by News Corp, which also owns 20th Century Fox, the studio behind Wolverine. They didn't find that too
funny,
too interesting, and so they let him go. He then went off, and instead of writing the Fox 411 column, which he is known, Roger Friedman is known as a respected entertainment journalist and respected, I don't want to say gossip journalist because he's a little bit above that, well, a lot above that. He wrote for New York Magazine. He is the person who became an authority on Michael Jackson and covered his child molestation trial. And
so it's kind of like Nikki Fink in a way. She reports about insidery stuff, but not gossip. It's fact.
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy that announced that John Kerry would be running for president because he overheard it at an Academy Awards party.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's very well known and has broken numerous stories and is respected. And I saw him in Cannes, and he was constantly on the red carpet, or at least twice I saw him on the red carpet. And I asked him what he was up to, and he said he was doing this new website, showbiz411.com, but that it would be moving to a bigger platform. very soon. And I tried to ask him, well, I did ask him what platform that was. I was personally interested. I was glad to see he was landing on his feet. Turns out he was hired by The Hollywood Reporter, and his website is now going to be one of their blogs online. And he started while in Cannes.
Well, good for him. But what, you know, I'm always glad that the people have jobs. But what do you think about the fact that he downloaded Wolverine and wrote a review about it? You know, a good review, by the way.
Yeah, he actually talked the film up. And I talked to him about that. And he said, you know, for him, he had been at Fox for 10 years. He had talked to the lawyers to let them know where he had downloaded it, what website it was on. And he figured they knew about it. And so he thinks he was sold up the river, and he has some legal action pending over this. And he really feels like he was made the scapegoat for this film leaking. But
that's preposterous.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we could try and get him on and see what he has to say about it. He might not have anything to say about it because he's in the middle of legal litigation.
Yeah.
So, you know, I found it interesting that The Hollywood Reporter would hire him, given that Fox is a big advertiser. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have hired him. He is a respected journalist, and maybe he made a mistake with this whole Wolverine thing. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he had permission. Maybe he didn't.
Yeah, but what are you saying? News Corp's not going to advertise in The Hollywood Reporter? It's one of the major trades.
There's some talk about that. Who knows whether that's
true?
And
even if they didn't, who cares? Everybody else will.
Right. Well, it's good for Roger Freeman. We'll see if we can get him on the show, and he can talk about that.
Yeah, use those connections of yours.
And he can actually talk about Michael Jackson, because, of course, Michael Jackson is preparing all these shows in London because he wants to bring the world to him. He doesn't want to go on tour. So he sold out like 50 shows. Well, apparently, Roger Freeman is an expert on Jackson and has all these inside leads into his world. And he said that Jackson is going to do 3 shows and then cancel all the others. Or not necessarily cancel all the others, but at least postpone them by saying, I'm too tired, I can't go on. That he didn't really want to do 50 shows. He wanted to do, 3 or 4. And that's what he's going to do. Well, so we'll see if that actually happens.
Does he have insider information like Nikki Fink, like all this stuff that's going on with William Morris and the Endeavor merger?
I don't know if he really is on that side of the fence. He works out of New York, so I don't know if he's
he's more of a New Yorker guy.
More of a New Yorker guy.
No, I ask this because I want to talk about my favorite little inside baseball moment.
Which Nikki Fink does cover quite well.
Quite well. And the bloodbath that is the William Morris agency, letting go of 100 agents and all the assistants as well. Or at least most
now, the reason
of them.
They
I think
did
some
this,
of them. What?
The reason they did that, and we should say, is because they announced that they would be merging with Endeavor, a smaller agency, but one that has become quite the upstart.
Right, but one thing that Nikki Fink talks about is it a merger or is it Endeavor's takeover?
Well, and a lot of people are saying that Endeavor is taking over William Morris.
That's what I mean. It's more really more of a takeover than a merger, which I find fascinating because Endeavor is quite a bit smaller than William Morris. So William Morris must have really been hurting.
Their clients are just more prestigious and they at times make more money.
Yeah. William Morris has been around for like 111 years, and Endeavor has been around for like 15. I find that it's really interesting. I know that another thing that Nikki Fink talks about is whether Jim Wyatt, who's currently, I don't know, what is he, CEO of William Morris?
He's the head of William Morris.
Yeah, whatever his exact title is, he's head of William Morris. And wouldn't that have just meant that he was instrumental in these merger talks?
Well, he was instrumental in these merger talks, and a lot of people feel he was instrumental in William Morris needing to merge in the first place.
Because there's talks now that he's getting kicked out of the new William Morris Entertainment or William Morris Endeavor or whatever the hell WME is supposed to stand for, but that he is being told all his friends are advising him to leave before he gets fired. And that's, from what I understand, kind of where it is right now. Is he going to stay? Is he going to go?
I think he's going to go because I think Jim Wyatt is somebody who came over in 1999, came over from ICM, another large agency, probably the number 2 agency in town at the time. And he was heading up ICM. He left, came over to William Morris. He was supposed to turn William Morris around. And
well,
instead,
because he was actually co-heading ICM with Jeff Berg, and he was supposed to be, between the two of them, the nicer guy, the better guy.
Well, you know, unfortunately for him, it seems that a lot of people at William Morris are finding fault with him for leading them into a situation where they needed to merge in the first place. And I think that to a large extent, he's, well, I'm not at William Morris, so I can't say, but I do know that they're very upset, and they're probably upset because people are being fired. They let go, as you mentioned, 100 employees, which is 15% of their workforce, and including, by the way, Alan Gasmer, which—
He was it when you and I worked there. Alan Gasmer was it.
I know, and they kept Rob Carlson, and between the two of them, Alan Gasmer is a motion picture lit agent, Rob Carlson is a lit agent who I think does both motion picture and television, and Rob Carlson is staying, and Alan Gasmer is not. Now, back in the 90s, they were the spec script kings of Hollywood.
Yeah, and, you know, spec scripts aren't really the big thing anymore, but, and, you know, Alan Gasmer was also probably pretty expensive. But I was really, that really surprised me, and it really surprised me that Jim Wyatt was being kicked out. I mean, I know that he kind of screwed up, that kind of majorly screwed up, but William Morris was sort of screwed up to begin with. And I know that there were a lot of factions, a lot of cliques, and, you know, whose clique were you in? But I was very surprised. I just assumed he was integral to this. I'm fascinated that he was not.
Well, he was integral in the merger. He won't be integral moving forward if he leaves.
But wouldn't he have known that if he was going to help put this merger together, that there was every chance that he was going to get kicked out? Did he not realize that?
I'm sure he did. He's a smart guy.
I mean, there's talk that he would get, you know, like a $25 million golden parachute to leave. It doesn't sound too bad to me. But from what I read, he owed a lot of money.
Well, a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this initially, you mentioned that all of these agents who were inevitably going to be let go may have no place to go.
Yeah.
Sure enough, Nikki Fink on her blog, because she covers this subject incredibly well, found out that William Morris, during the whole merger talks, sent out cease and desist letters to other agencies, preventing them from hiring agents that they may, in the end, let go.
Isn't that unbelievable? I can't believe you can't prevent somebody from making a living. How could, what precedent?
Well, first off, some of these agents were under contract. And so Nikki Fink says,
by letting
them
go, they were breaking the contract anyway.
Nikki Fink writes, WMA wanted to make sure it didn't lose any of the agents it would ultimately decide were quote-unquote safe in the merger. And of course, safe meant that they would be kept on.
Right.
But this also had the effect of hampering those agents who, at the time, didn't know they were going to be laid off from finding jobs early.
Yep.
One agency owner who received Glazer's letter, and Glazer is
Patty
Glazer, the lawyer who sent out the cease and desist letter. Fink goes on to write, one agency owner who received Glazer's letter from WMA called it, quote-unquote, despicable and, quote-unquote, inhumane.
It is. Can't prevent people from making a living. Can't put people in a situation where their job is unsafe and not expect them to go out and try and find another job. And now, yeah, exactly like I said, there are 100 agents and assistants out there who are all fighting for just a small percentage of jobs.
Right. Well, we have once again reached the end of our allotted time here. We don't really have an allotted time, but we are trying to keep these shows within an hour. If you want to write to us with feedback, you can do so via email. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That email address again is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can give us a call. And the number, Karen, you have the number.
No, I never have the number.
Okay, it's 888-567-7263. That's 888-567-SAND. So give us a call. We hope to be reading some emails, some of your emails, right during the episode as well. We'll review all of the voicemails that we get and play a few on the air. So if we said something wrong, correct us. If you agree with some of the things we said, let us know. And
work at William Morris. Give us a call.
Who's our number? Give us a call. Well, yeah, if you used to work at William Morris, give us a call. I'm sure they're all calling Nikki Fink instead.
Hang on, my phone's ringing. And check out our Facebook page. And what
yes,
else do we have?
Facebook.
LinkedIn.
We're on LinkedIn. We have a group on LinkedIn. We have a group on Facebook. We have a page on Facebook. Or is it a group on Facebook? We have something on Facebook. I don't know what it is. We are on Twitter. You can find us. I'm Sperling. Karen, you're some...
K Woody with a Y. K Woody 3939.
And of course, you can also find us Showbiz Sandbox at Twitter, so you can subscribe to the podcast feed. You can find us on iTunes. You can subscribe through your RSS reader. If you want to send us stories to consider for next week's episode, you can do so either via email, or you can tag a link on Delicious, the social bookmarking website, with the tag Showbiz Sandbox, all one word.
Good talking to you. Welcome home.
Thank you very much. Until next week, play nice.